You're listening to Non-Zero World. I'm your host, Connor Eccles. Each week, I break down the latest developments in U.S. foreign policy and other global news, and I interview a leading expert or activist. To gain access to full-length episodes and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at Robert Wright's Non-Zero newsletter at nonzero.org. Hello and welcome to Non-Zero World. I'm your host, Connor Eccles. Here are some of this week's most important headlines. Israeli soldiers are using what one intelligence source called incredibly crappy algorithms to determine whether a house is empty before bombing it, leading them to approve airstrikes on buildings that are still occupied by civilians, according to a new report from 972 magazine. Rather than assessing the targets individually, the Israeli army relies on the algorithms, which are based on phone usage data, to mark neighborhoods as green, meaning that fewer than 20% of residents remain there. "Everything is green," recalled an anonymous intelligence source. Quote, "The whole area we were in Khan Yunis, was marked green, and it clearly wasn't," end quote. A previously unknown pro-Palestinian militant group fired a pair of rockets from Syria that landed in open areas near Israeli settlements in the Golan Heights. Israel, which says it holds Syria directly responsible for the attacks, responded by conducting airstrikes on Syrian military sites. The escalation comes as Israel has been holding talks with Syria in an effort to prevent a full-scale war between the two countries. Such fears are not without historical precedent. In the lead-up to the Six-Day War in 1967, Palestinian armed groups carried out a series of attacks on Israel from bases in Syria, and Israel responded by attacking the Syrian military, leading to an escalation spiral that helped spark an all-out war. Progressive politician Lee Jae-myung sailed to victory in this week's South Korean presidential election, ending a period of political turmoil that began when his predecessor attempted to impose martial law in December. In his inaugural address, Lee pledged to break with his predecessor's hawkish foreign policy by opening a communication channel with North Korea and pursuing peace through, quote, talks and cooperation, end quote. Lee's election could mark a turning point for East Asia, according to an analyst at the Eurasia Group consultancy, who notes that Lee is also expected to ease tensions with China. Meta signed a 20-year deal to buy power from a nuclear plant in Illinois, joining other tech giants like Microsoft, Amazon, and Google, all of which have turned to nuclear energy in order to meet the growing power needs of their AI data centers. As tech leaders place big bets on nuclear energy, a nuclear engineering professor at the University of Illinois warns that, quote, "the acceleration of AI is pushing our energy infrastructure to the limit," end quote. Negotiators from Russia and Ukraine met in Istanbul for a second round of direct peace talks, and they agreed on little besides a large-scale prisoner swap. European leaders joined Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in calling for new sanctions on Russia, with European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen saying that, quote, "pressure works as the Kremlin understands nothing else," end quote. U.S. Special Envoy Keith Kellogg, meanwhile, praised Ukraine's negotiating position as very reasonable, while complaining that Russia brought a very maximalist position to the talks, adding that he nonetheless hopes to find a bridge between the two sides. Chinese researchers used an AI model to find a molecule that can revive dead lithium-ion batteries, a discovery that could extend the life of electric vehicles while reducing waste. The team asked a specialized AI model to suggest molecules that could infuse lithium ions into a dead battery cell, with a focus on options that were inexpensive and easy to dissolve in an injectable electrolyte solution. The model offered three candidates, one of which was able to revive a dead battery six times in a row. Researchers say they hope to commercialize this method, though questions remain about how to apply it across battery packs that contain thousands of individual cells. Now let's go to my conversation about the state of Ukraine peace talks with Jennifer Kavanaugh, the head of military analysis at the Defense Priorities think tank. You can follow Jennifer on X at J.E. Kavanaugh. That's K-A-V-A-N-A-G-H. I hope you'll stick around. Hey, Jennifer, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks. How are you?
I'm good. Why don't I go ahead and get us started? So you are Jennifer Kavanaugh, the head of military analysis at the Defense Priorities think tank, which is sort of a conservative restraint oriented think tank here in DC. You've previously worked also at the Carnegie Endowment, if I'm correct, and the RAND Corporation. So a little bit all over the think tank landscape. And you are here today because we are going to discuss the state of peace talks in Ukraine. You followed this issue super closely, and I think that you have somewhat of an unconventional take on it compared to some people. And that's why I'm really excited to have you on for this conversation. So maybe to get us started. So, you know, we had another round of peace talks this week. We had a round 2 weeks ago that are the first direct peace talks since the early days of the war. Now, you've argued that Trump may better suit his interests by actually walking away entirely from the talks and allowing things to continue, that the U.S. has already achieved its objectives. Can you lay out that argument and help people understand why it may actually make sense for Trump to walk away?
Sure. So, you know, I don't see the United States as having a really strong strategic interest in Ukraine. And I think that's been true since the beginning of the war. I think the main interest that the United States had was preventing Russia from overrunning the entire country, which was successful. There's very little chance that even with no more U.S. military aid, Russia would be able to take control of Kyiv or Ukraine is going to collapse. So really, like, I see U.S. strategic objectives in the conflict as being complete and achieved. And that means that the United States has some flexibility here in terms of how it approaches the broader issue. I think the administration has sort of three key priorities here. The first is to get the U.S. out of Ukraine, to cut U.S. involvement. It continues to be a drain on U.S. military and diplomatic resources. It continues to put the United States at odds with Russia, as we saw this past weekend with Ukraine's drone attack. There's this question of, was the U.S. involved? Well, if the U.S. cut its involvement, that would no longer be a question or concern. So number one priority, get the U.S. out of Ukraine. Peace is one way to do that. But peace is not required for the United States to walk away. So I think that's important to keep in mind. And the other two objectives I see the administration having are much more important. One of them is to rebalance the relationship with Europe and to cut U.S. presence in Europe. And the third is to reset relations with Russia and to normalize those ties, both for long-term U.S. interests and to reduce the risk of some kind of a miscalculation and conflict between the two powers. So because I see those two other goals as more important, and because I don't see peace as required to achieve the U.S. Unraveling or unwinding its involvement, I see that there's this option for the United States to pursue its interests more effectively and more quickly by walking away from the day-to-day involvement in ongoing negotiations, cut U.S. involvement in Ukraine so the U.S. is no longer tied up, and then move forward on the other two goals. Move forward on rebalancing the relationship with Russia or resetting the relationship with Russia, and move forward on changing its posture in Europe. Those two goals are a little bit harder if the war is ongoing, but possible if the United States is no longer involved in Ukraine. And the other reason I think that it makes sense a little bit for the U.S. to walk away here is because, you know, there was a push initially to get the peace talks started. And I think the key takeaway that the administration came away with, rightly, is that the two sides aren't ready to stop fighting. The issue here isn't that there isn't a deal that would work for both sides, is that neither side is convinced that the time to stop fighting has been reached. And in that sense, you know, the U.S. can't force Russia to decide to stop fighting. It has the battlefield advantage. And it's not really well served by trying to coerce Ukraine into a deal that it doesn't want, because that's not going to last. And so stepping back and walking away, pursuing other U.S. interests in the European security space, and giving Ukraine and Russia time to continue to work bilaterally on talks, even if they're slow, makes a lot more sense than having the U.S. constantly involved on a day-to-day basis in a sort of losing battle to get these two sides to agree to something that they're not ready to agree to.
Well, that's very interesting. I mean, there's a lot of different kind of assumptions built in there that it might be helpful to dig into a little more. I think one that really jumps out is that You know, you argue that Ukraine is now capable of mounting, I guess, its own self-defense, or maybe in coordination with Europe. That has not generally been the take that I've heard for the length of this war, right? The argument has rather been that U.S. assistance, both in terms of weapons and in terms of intelligence sharing, helping with targeting, things like that, is essential to Ukraine's war effort. So what makes you disagree with those assessments?
Well, I don't think that Ukraine at this point has the ability to completely defend itself. I think that's an achievable goal for Ukraine. But I do believe that Ukraine can keep fighting for some time without U.S. support. The Europeans have ramped up their military support to Ukraine. And Ukraine's own defense industrial production has actually ramped up significantly. It's able to produce most of its own artillery systems now, as a lot of ammunition. It can produce 3 to 4 million drones per year, and even is making progress on some of the longer range strike missiles. And as we saw just over the past week or so, they are able to continue to impose costs on Russia. So I do see that without U.S. support, the amount of time that Ukraine can last on its own is probably limited. But I don't think it's immediate. Even if the U.S. cut off intelligence support, I believe Ukraine could continue for some time to maintain its defensive lines. And I also don't see it as necessarily a bad thing if it's time limited. Like, ultimately, we would like to see this war end. And the U.S. may not be able to force Ukraine to stop fighting right away, but it can make it difficult to continue for it to continue fighting indefinitely. I do actually think that a deal that Ukraine gets today is better than a deal that Ukraine gets in 6 months or a year. I think time is not on Ukraine's side, but that's not a decision that the U.S. can make for Kyiv or Zelensky. So if they want to keep fighting and deal with Russia when their battlefield position has eroded further, that's sort of a choice that, they have the right to make. And, you know, ultimately, you do have to get to this point where both sides decide they want to stop fighting. Right. And U.S. military aid is probably going to run out over the summer anyway, in terms of the aid packages that are coming from Biden. So I guess I see it as sort of, it will allow Ukraine to continue for some time, but speed us towards this point where both sides decide that fighting anymore doesn't make sense.
Right. Yeah, I guess another area that I'm kind of curious about within this is that, well, I guess pulling back, there's an argument about what exactly Russia is trying to achieve here, right? On the extreme end, it's you know, that Russia is an imperial state that is trying to conquer as much of Europe as possible. On the more sort of low-key end, it's that, you know, they're very afraid of, you know, NATO expansion, that they're very determined to keep things down throughout there. But sort of drawing from those assumptions, the argument is that Russia essentially is fighting a proxy war with the West, potentially, as much as it is fighting a war with Ukraine. And so that kind of brings the question of, you know, why is the U.S. actually capable of splitting these into two separate things, right? Because on one side, Russia, if they are indeed engaged in something that is a proxy war, and they are trying to deal with the U.S. on issues of broader security within Europe and on issues potentially of stability between NATO and Russia, how could we separate these issues out if the U.S. just pulls back? Why would Russia be then incentivized to keep talking?
Well, so I do think the issues can be solved. I mean, I definitely agree with you that part of this war is about broader strategic issues and about Ukraine's alignment and relationship with the West. When Putin talks about solving the root causes of the war, some of those root causes are things that have to do directly with Ukraine, like Ukraine's potential membership in NATO, increasing Western alignment in the lead up to the war. And some of them are root causes that have to do with NATO generally and the constant expansion of NATO up to Russia's borders and the increasing deployments of NATO capabilities close to those borders. So you're definitely right that there are these broader strategic issues. In my view, Like the idea that we're going to have some kind of peace settlement that ties up both the Russia-Ukraine issues, because there are other Russia-Ukraine issues about Russian minorities and about the orientation of Kyiv's government and other sort of direct bilateral issues. The idea that we're going to have a peace agreement that solves all of those problems and addresses European security, that's going to tie everything up into one nice package, that seems very difficult to me and very unrealistic. Just looking at how difficult and complicated the negotiations have been already, it seems much more likely to me that splitting the issues makes a lot more sense. That having some kind of agreement between Ukraine and Russia that deals with, not just territorial issues, not just like the small things like prisoner of war transfers, but deals with the alignment issue. Ukraine will ultimately have to like voluntarily accept a position of non-alignment and say that it will not pursue NATO membership. That will be a requirement. So that can be dealt with between Russia and Ukraine. Questions about Ukrainian military capabilities, if there's going to be limits on long-range strike weapons or limits on foreign forces inside of Ukraine. These are things that Russia and Ukraine can deal with separately. And then these broader strategic issues are issues that definitely have to be dealt with, but I don't see them as necessarily having to be dealt with at the same time or in the same set of negotiations. And as I mentioned, you know, when I talk about walking away from Ukraine, I'm not suggesting walking away entirely from the whole issue. The United States could continue to encourage Ukraine and Russia to have direct talks, and after a time could also re-engage with Russia
right,
directly on these broader strategic issues. So I do think that progress on these broader big picture root causes issues could be happening at two levels at once, even if the U.S. wasn't involved day to day in the Ukraine piece of those discussions.
Right. Right. And I think one thing that really does play in favor of your argument here is that there is an inherent weirdness to the U.S. sort of shifting to be the primary mediator in a lot of ways. Right. It's that we've been such a muscular defender of Ukraine for the past few years. We continue to arm them. And then it puts the Trump administration, frankly, in a very awkward position now as it's balancing between, sort of wanting to turn up the pressure on Russia, but also offer them some carrots in ways that are very unattractive to the political scene here in the U.S. So it does put the U.S. in a very unusual position.
Yeah, that's definitely true. The U.S. is not a natural negotiator or natural mediator here, because the United States hasn't been a neutral party since the beginning of the war, and still really isn't a neutral party in the sense that it's still providing military aid to Ukraine. It also doesn't have the same level of leverage with both sides. So its ability to put pressure on both sides is limited. It has significant ability to coerce Kyiv in the sense that it can cut aid and it can cut intelligence sharing and it can impose other types of threats. It can certainly threaten sanctions or even impose additional sanctions on Russia. I don't see those sanctions as likely to change Putin's calculus. And I think that's why the administration has leaned more on the carrot side. It's less about, that approach has gotten a lot of criticism from European allies as well as in the United States. But I do think it's just a recognition of reality that the sticks the U.S. has to impose on Russia haven't been working and are unlikely to make Putin any more likely to come to the negotiating table. And so trying to incentivize Russia to negotiate in good faith has been the approach. The problem is that they haven't found like the right carrots yet to get Putin to give up the battlefield advantage that he feels like he has.
Right. Well, maybe this is a good time to shift into the ongoing talks, right? So as I mentioned at the beginning, there was a first round in Istanbul about 2.5-3 weeks ago now, and there was a second round that took place this past Monday. What is your general assessment of this early couple rounds of talks? Has there been progress that you're keeping an eye on?
I mean, overall, I think the outcome has been pretty positive. The spin in the media has been very negative. that these have been, you know, a failure or totally a disappointment. But I mean, in my view, every time they have a round of talks where they agree to meet again, that's sort of a good sign. If you look back at many conflicts that are, you know, difficult and intractable, whether it's the Vietnam War or the Korean War, they have multiple rounds of talks. I think Korean War had like over 100 meetings over several years. Think about how many years the Vietnam War, the peace negotiations were ongoing before they actually reached an agreement. So any agreement is going to take a long time to reach. So I think that's important to keep in mind. And so far we've seen, pretty productive meetings, significant prisoner of war exchanges. That's good. Confidence building measures. And then you have the exchange of memos. I think the exchange of memos maybe was a little bit disappointing in the sense that both sides immediately started from like very maximalist positions. But that's sort of to be expected. And they did agree again after this latest round to meet and talk again. So in my view, it hasn't been negative. It's been pretty positive. And the administration should really be and has been encouraging them to continue to meet, to keep this channel open.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious. You mentioned that obviously the war in Vietnam took a lot of rounds to be resolved, a lot of rounds of talks, that a lot of conflicts tend to take time. But, you know, in your experience as someone who follows military affairs quite closely, what does it generally take for gaps to be bridged? Is it just that both sides have to conclude sort of at the same time that there's nothing worth fighting for anymore? Or like, what does that look like?
Some wars end when the military balance shifts enough that like one side is basically forced to surrender. In other cases, I think you do need both sides to decide that peace is better than continuing to fight, that the deal on the table is better than continued war. And that can require a lot of a lot of back and forth. It requires compromises on both sides. I mean, I do think that in this case, we see sort of the outlines of what the final deal will look like. It's just a matter of getting both sides to decide that like now is the time to reach it. And I think that those terms are basically like some form of arms non-alignment or arms neutrality, where Ukraine is outside of NATO, probably has a path to EU membership, doesn't have security guarantees, but is given the ability to build sufficient military capabilities of its own, and has some limits maybe on long-range strike weapons, like geographic restrictions, but is able to produce indigenously, to have a strong its own defense industrial base, and receives some types of defensive Western aid for a certain period. And then in return, Russia gets reduction in sanctions and probably assurances from the West on, additional NATO expansion or at least keeping Ukraine out of NATO. And so I think that the area of negotiation will ultimately end up being around sort of what this armed Ukraine looks like. I think that there's openness on the Russian side to talk about this as well as on the Ukrainian side. Although Ukraine, doesn't want to accept caps on its capabilities, I think there's a willingness to have these discussions. And then there'll be some, protections for Russian minorities inside Ukraine and some of these other bilateral issues. But so I think we see this outlines of like what the ultimate deal will look like. The challenge is just getting both sides to actually get there.
Right.
And on the Russian side, I think there's a sense that they still have enough military advantage on the battlefield and a desire to push through on this like summer offensive that they've just started. So it's possible that in the fall there's more openness. On the Ukrainian side, I think the big sticking point is this desire to have a ceasefire before talks start, which I think is unrealistic. It has been like pushed and supported by the Europeans. Ultimately, Russia's not going to agree to a ceasefire until they've had negotiations. So the model here is really going to have to be one of talking while fighting. Which is happening now, which again, I think is a positive thing.
Well, why does Russia not want to have a ceasefire before negotiations?
So I think that Russia is very focused on making sure that what is called as the root causes are addressed, and they're unwilling to stop fighting until they're sure that these security concerns that they have about Ukraine's military and Ukraine's military alignment will be addressed. They are concerned that if they stop fighting, the West will use this as a time to rearm Ukraine. Ukraine will be stronger, and then the war will just begin again. So they don't have a lot of confidence that a ceasefire would, they don't have a lot of confidence that a ceasefire would last forever if it was imposed. Their belief is that it's a temporary rest and refit period for Ukraine. And they'd end up losing the advantage that they have. So I think that's the calculation on the Russian side. And I mean, it is certainly the case that the West has made lots of commitments to Russia, especially around NATO expansion, that have then been broken. So there certainly is reason for Russia to be suspicious of Western promises, just as there is reason for Ukraine and the West to be suspicious of Russian promises on the other side. So I think high levels of distrust make it hard to have a ceasefire before negotiations have started, before both sides, or especially before the Russian side, believes that they are getting a deal that will serve their interests.
Right. Can you talk a little bit more? You know, you've referenced a few times, and this is something I've said in the past too, that it seems that Russia is on the front foot on the battlefield, that they do have the advantage. It's been sort of a slow grinding conflict in many ways going on 2 years now, really. But can you, give a bit more of a detailed description of what the battlefield actually looks like today and why that is so beneficial to Russia?
Well, I don't know if we should say beneficial. I mean, it's really a war of attrition at this point. Neither side is making big gains. Russia's gains have been very slow and very costly. They're losing people at a very high rate. Their approach is basically one of just like brute force, of trying to throw enough people and enough weapons at the front lines that they're able to sort of creep forward because they have the advantage in terms of mass. Ukraine has been very effective, even though it has manpower and weapon shortages, in slowing down Russian progress using drones and other types of capabilities. So I think you see it's very slow progress on the Russian side. However, Russia is still making progress. Russia is still, able to, move forward at this slow rate. And so I think there's a hope that, on the Russian side, that they will be able to push through it during the summer and gain some additional territory in these four regions in the east that they're trying to, solidify their hold on. I think we should recognize that a battlefield advantage here is a pretty slim and not all that attractive advantage, but an advantage nonetheless.
I guess it's just interesting because there's a seeming if they are on the advantage, I guess the big reason for them to not want to stop the war right now is that they view themselves as being on the front foot, right? They view that as beneficial for their position in the peace talks. But if the advantage is really this small and it's not potentially that beneficial, then I guess I kind of don't understand that, right? There's something to kind of square there.
Well, I think there's a hope on the Russian side that that they can maybe speed up their gains if they are able to mass just a little bit more force and Ukraine starts to collapse a little bit. There's a recognition that, Western military aid is going to start to taper off here. The packages that Biden set up and that were in the pipeline when he left office are running out. We've already seen some reports from the Pentagon that they're shifting certain military capabilities away from Ukraine to other U.S. military requirements in the Middle East and elsewhere. So I think there's a hope that on the Russian side, that they can turn like, small military advantage into a bigger one that would allow them to achieve some cascading effects. And it is true that Ukraine is sort of just barely holding on, so it's not out of the totally out of the question. But again, I think that the real issue here is just that Russia wants to make it clear that they're willing to fight for as long as it takes. And they said this in their first round of negotiations. You know, they said, like, you know, we will keep fighting for years if required. How long are you willing to keep fighting? And I think their calculation here is that they can fight longer. And so they just need to hold out for long enough that Kyiv decides, like, enough. We have to kind of sue for peace. And in which case, Russia would have an advantage at the negotiating table as well as in the battlefield. And so I think that's what they're kind of playing here, is that we're kind of in this, like, knife-edge situation. And both sides are trying to shift, trying to achieve large shifts in momentum. And are hoping that the other side is maybe weaker than it might seem, or that they kind of push them past a tipping point, instead of just slipping backwards slowly, they fall back in big in bigger chunks.
Right, right. And how? I mean, you know, it's a very long front line. I guess it's like 1,000+ miles, right, or something of that scale. You know, how, to what extent are both sides kind of dug in along that line now, right? Are there major defensive fortifications on both sides that sort of militate against the possibility of significant movement, even if Russia is able to throw a lot of forces forward? Like, sort of, what does that look like today?
Yeah, well, on the Russian side, they have very strong defenses, which was a real impediment to Ukraine making any progress when they tried to launch their offensive in 2023. The Ukrainian side, they were slow to build up defenses. They have made progress in building up those defenses, especially using drones and other types of barriers. So that will definitely slow Russian progress. But one of the challenges, I think, of this, you know, battlefield where Ukraine and Russia are fighting is that it's not like just a barren fields where both sides can dig in trenches and put mines there and then, you know, prevent the other side from moving forward. There are towns and cities and other types of things that get in the way. So there are still, like, spots that are weaker, especially on the Ukrainian side. So even though Ukraine's barriers, I think, will slow Russian progress, I don't think they can stop it, especially given manpower shortages on the Ukrainian side. That naturally leads to gaps because the smaller number of personnel that Ukraine has can't be everywhere at once. That means that there are soft spots where Russia could potentially, like, push through.
Yeah. And what is the extent of the manpower shortage at this point? Like, I understood it to be that even fairly early on in the war, really, like a year, maybe a year and a half in, the average age of a Ukrainian soldier was already quite high, sort of infamously, like in the 40s. And they've fought against any idea of lowering the age of conscription to more like the U.S., more like 18. I think it currently is at 25. But that's just some context. But what is the exact nature of the manpower shortage?
I mean, it's pretty severe at this point. I think the average age is still very old. I mean, if you look at the pictures that you get in the media, most of the soldiers are in their 40s. They're also quite tired. Most of the soldiers who have been fighting for a long time now without a break. They have made some progress in recruiting. You know, they did lower the age to 25. They have been trying to get voluntary recruits, so even though they're not conscripting people 18 to 25, they are being quite aggressive in trying to market military opportunities to try to get people to voluntarily sign up. And that has yielded some progress. So I think that they've had some recruiting successes, but nowhere near enough to actually solve their manpower problems. And they just, any progress they made is sort of swamped by the fact that Russia just has so many more people. And is able to mass personnel in a way that Ukraine just can't. So the manpower shortages continue to be a huge problem, probably a bigger problem than the weapons shortages, and much harder to overcome.
Right. Right. And, you know, one of the biggest news lines this week around Russia-Ukraine, of course, was Ukraine's very bold attack against Russian strategic bombers and various things well within Russia. I mean, we're, you know, more than 1,000 miles from the border in a lot of cases. And so sort of a spectacular attack in some ways. And a lot of people who are strong backers of Ukraine have argued that, you know, this shows some sort of advantage in their military position or some sort of resiliency that might give them more leverage in the talks. Do you share that assessment?
No, not really. I tend to disagree for a couple of reasons. The first is I don't actually think it changes Russian military capabilities or their ability to continue fighting on the front lines. Yes, it was a blow to Russia's strategic bombers and to their and the not insignificant loss of strategic aircraft. So I think it's like it's notable. It's a loss. I'm not kind of diminishing the challenge that Russia will have to replace those aircraft or those capabilities. But Russia has a large air force. Lots of diverse capabilities, has plenty of ways that it can continue to strike what are mostly Ukrainian civilian targets. That's what they've been striking mostly. They don't need those strategic bombers to do that. So they have many ways that they can continue doing that. In my view, the attack, you know, puts no pressure on their broader defense production, or their ability to provide enough weapons or personnel for the front lines on the Eastern Front. So it doesn't change their ability to continue the war of attrition. I don't think it affects necessarily their calculations, the Russian calculations about whether it's time to stop fighting. It's a significant cost, but at the same time, I think it hardens, if anything, Putin's resolve, as well as playing into his narrative that it's Ukraine that's the aggressor. That it's Ukraine that's the impediment to peace, not Russia, and so can help build popular support. And I also think it potentially challenges U.S. support to Ukraine in the sense that I think there were a lot of people in the D.C. community, close to the administration especially, that were very concerned that Ukraine struck these nuclear-capable bombers without informing the United States ahead of time, given the potential nuclear implications and nuclear escalation that could have caused, because the U.S. is sort of implicated by association, even if the U.S. wasn't involved in the specific attack. And so I could see more attacks like this potentially leading the United States to move more quickly to cut off intelligence sharing or to take other steps to step back from Ukraine, seeing it as a risky ally that's looking that might intentionally entrap and entangle the United States in a conflict that it doesn't want to be involved in. So in my view, you know, maybe it gives Ukraine a morale boost, but it's sort of like the Kursk incursion. Like, are the costs really worth it? Is the cost of the retaliation that Ukraine's likely to suffer? Is the cost of the planning and other resources that went into the attack, are those things worth some kind of small morale gain when ultimately it's not going to change the actual operational trajectory of the war, the strategic trajectory, or your ability to gain leverage at the negotiating table? So in my view, it is more likely to hurt Ukraine in the long term than help it. You know, though I know there are others who disagree.
Right. Right. And can you flesh out a little bit more for listeners exactly why the attacks on Russian bombers, and specifically the fact that Ukraine didn't tell the U.S., why that poses a risk of nuclear escalation?
Sure. So, you know, like the United States, Russia has a nuclear triad. So they have capabilities that they can use by air, by land, and by sea. And the air portion of that triad relies on these strategic bombers, The bombers are dual use, so they can be armed with conventional weapons, which they have been in the context of the Ukraine war, but they can also be armed with nuclear capabilities. And one of the reasons why they were sitting open on the airfield instead of being protected is that this was sort of a post-Cold War, you know, arrangement that under broader arms control, that like in order to build confidence on both sides, bombers are generally kept sort of like open on the airfield so that both sides can see where the others are, with the idea that like we're not looking to attack each other, but we can build confidence by being transparent. You know, anything that reduces Russia's nuclear capabilities, that takes away portions of its delivery vehicles, could damage the balance that the United States and Russia have set up in terms of nuclear capabilities. A lot of the arms control agreements that were set up during the Cold War have lapsed. But still, this idea of balance between the two sides has been very important in maintaining the strategic stability. So an attack that takes out some of Russia's nuclear bombers, even though it didn't take out all of them, and so they still have some, and they still obviously have the other two legs of the triad, but this is a it damages their in some ways it damages their ability to carry out a nuclear attack, and so the fact that the U.S. wasn't wasn't warned about this ahead of time is a little bit problematic, because ultimately these nuclear arms agreements are between the United States and Russia, not between Ukraine and Russia. So if this attack was perceived by the Kremlin as being something the US was involved in, a US supported attack on Russian nuclear capabilities, that has real implications for how the Kremlin might respond, not just towards Kyiv, but also towards the United States. It has an impact on broader arms control and strategic civility discussions. So it has really significant implications. So the fact that Ukraine did this at all is very risky. And the fact that it would do it without talking to Washington beforehand raises questions about how much Washington can trust Kyiv to make decisions that are strategically smart and that protect U.S. interests as well as Ukrainian interests.
Right. Well, that's one of the very interesting challenges that we've seen in this war and other conflicts, in which the U.S. doesn't get itself directly involved, but sort of acts as a sponsor for a proxy, where there is an unwillingness maybe to acknowledge the difference in national interest potentially between the U.S. and its allies. Sometimes those do diverge. And when they do diverge, it becomes very difficult to kind of square that when the argument is that we must back them emphatically. So I guess this is sort of in favor of your argument at the top of this conversation about why the U.S. Might want to pull back.
Yeah, and I do think the Trump administration has been much more forward-leaning than the Biden administration was.
This was a free preview of Non-Zero World. To unlock the rest of this conversation and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at nonzero.org.